precisely what that meant. They knew that words would not suffice for robber barons. Don't play nice. Tens of thousands among their ranks as they rode at night by their river banks. The flags were red and the corn was green. Oklahoma, 1917. Of exploitation, the gilded age of revolution, from Prairie Creek to Mexico, to the fields where the cotton grows. When conscription came, they said, no more shall poor men fight a rich man's war. They blew up bridges, cut the wires, they agitated and conspired. Sometimes rebels take the reins, other ones end up in chains. The flags were red and the corn was green. Oklahoma, 1917.
So shortly after the first phone call from Nick Whitehead, I got a second one, and this continued the discussion, and you get to continue to hear it if you continue to listen. So you went to Depot Park. I'm reiterating what you're saying because now I'm recording it. Nick, you went to Depot Park. This is about half an hour or an hour after your last call. And you ran into Jeremy, Leonard, and Chris, who are the people who have been monitoring the Benchlands city employees.
Yeah, and they said that park has to be get real spick and span. They thank me for picking up a little trash there. They said, we're walking on glass here, he says.
How nice. Well, what did he say?
An essential human surface. Why would they be walking on glass?
Well, they probably...
For the neighbors.
Yeah, that's... Of course, Depot Park, you know, is a place that 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, actually, now, Drew Glover and the council majority actually set it up as a gone-by-dawn sleeping spot, and it was... Rafa Sonnenfeld organized a hostility group that forced the council to change its whole opinion, if you remember. That was in the spring.
Okay, well, I hope those buzzards have died off in the meantime. Anyway, so I talked with them, and I pointed out the need for some straw matting or something, berms, I call them, to soak up the rainwater that was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, good idea. And so I said, yeah, and who's responsible for this? Public Works? And they said, call the city manager.
Yeah.
Ah, okay, so I go up to City Hall. I try to write a note because it's very effective if you write
more effective. Notes. Yeah, no, I hear you.
And the whole city office complex is closed, and it has been closed since December 20th.
And will be closed probably until January 3rd is my guess.
Yeah, so why would the city point men on homelessness not know that? Why would they direct me up there? Well, I guess they thought I could make a telephone call, but there's no service on the phone either. So,
well, it's also their responsibility, Nick. It's not yours. Come on, they're the ones
who... No, it's not mine.
No, it's ridiculous. You know, I think...
But I just think that's poor service. That's really poor service when there's a crisis.
I think
like,
it's...
ongoing crisis.
Yeah, and I mean, this is... Remember, this is what they did last year, similarly, they being the city.
Yeah.
They went after the whole park when things were closed down and people couldn't really act. Their city council's on vacation. In this situation,
yeah.
You know, the city manager, you only have now is an interim city manager anyway. What's her name? Hennard. There's a new one coming in, you know, in a week or two.
Oh, he's not here yet. Yeah, Hope Noggle from... Watsonville.
Right, although that, you know, I don't expect that to be much better. I mean, no indication necessarily is. So, yeah, have you talked to any of the people, you know, in the Depot Park, any of the, for their thoughts?
No, because I had to spend all my time going up, traipsing up to City Hall and back.
Yeah, well, it's good exercise.
I did take another walk around it, and I did go and check those bathrooms in the building at Depot Park, and they are not open. there was a woman actually opening the women's bathroom with a key, and she was a lowly employee, no doubt, and I said, why are these bathrooms locked? And she said, oh, I don't know, they're only for the COVID people. She meant the COVID mobile clinic. Only they can go and use the bathrooms.
Yeah.
And so the public, the regular public, can't use those bathrooms at the moment.
Yeah, SOP.
It's just these arbitrary policies that come into play.
Yeah. Oh, they aren't arbitrary. They are very much intentional, I think.
Well, what would be the intention of that one?
They believe the homeless people are a reckless, vandalistic lot. And if you open up one bathroom, it's only... And limping toward you, it's the December 30th edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the final one of 2021. This is going to be a weary one for me. I just got my booster shot, and I'm feeling pretty darn tired, I got to tell you, but we'll see what we can do with this netcast. What have we got coming up? Well, it'll be kind of a surprise, but... I guess we got an interview with Monica Tematella, who's the Petaluma contact I have, who's been advising me on what's going on with the successful injunction they have up there to defending the rights of homeless people. And we're going to be having, the familiar whip into shape Wes White's going to be reporting on how things are going in the Pajaro River. Again, those folks, I should say, who have moved to the Bridge Street encampment and successfully got an injunction for a while, but now have been mainly relocated, as I understand it, to motel rooms, perhaps under the room key funding. I'm not sure, but you'll hear some of that. And you'll also be hearing me wandering through the benchlands and describing what I see and having an occasional conversation with the people I meet. So there's probably more, but that's all I can think of at the moment. But you'll be hearing it, so there's no need to go any further. Although if you do, that's what you'll hear.
Tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs, they simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with our perennial reporter, Wes White from Salinas, who can find his video work on the YouTube channel John Doe 13K. Two words, John, J-O-H-N, Doe 13K, D-O-E 13K, all one word there. John Doe 13K, two words. So, and you can catch the video part of it. He covers a lot of the struggles of folks resisting police harassment and the shutdown of encampments when the city's like to pretend, but actually have no real alternatives for folks other than hide out or get out. And mostly it's get out here. So we're going to go first to Wes talking about the Pajaro River encampment that became the bridge kind of warming center, refugee center in Watsonville, and that recently has moved into some motel rooms. And here's what he has to say about that, as well as some other areas as well. So today is the 29th of December. It's nearing 6:30 in the evening. And I've just caught Wes White, who's been keeping an eye on, and an ear on both Watsonville and the Pajaro River folks who've been struggling to maintain a community, even as they're driven from pillar to post by first Monterey County authorities and then by Watsonville gendarmes. And also, I guess, there's your own home trek ground, Salinas, which I assume there's not a lot going on, but you've noted in the past, Wes, that in spite of your optimistic conversations with members of the Salinas City Council, nonetheless, the sweeps seem to be continuing, or at least they were for the last few months. You also, of course, are facing charges for, along with three other people, for essentially peacefully reminding authorities in a very physical, visible way, or through documenting, that there is there should be accommodations for people before their own homes are destroyed and they're forced out of where they're living. So that's kind of my intro. Is that, how does that cover it?
Yeah, no, that's fine. Well, so in Watsonville, I guess the city's saying that everyone has been given vouchers, which for the most part they have. So folks are in hotels. The Watsonville city was really quick to put up a fence and a security guard and a dumpster. Luckily, we were able to take everything away. You know, so it didn't be claimed by the city. I mean, almost everything is brand new out there anyway. So most folks are in a place right now. The big goal for that, for me anyway, would be to keep everyone in, you know, perpetually housed.
So how many people got vouchers and how, so to speak, temporary motel lodging?
That's a good question. The detail on that, I do not know. I'm guessing about two dozen people.
Now, there was some controversy way back when you and I were at the Pajaro River in the, I guess it was back in November, and they were first offering vouchers, but then they only brought two, and then they brought five, and then they said they'd bring 10, and the issue was for two nights, or was it then for five, and then it was for 10, and then it was for five again. Do we know what the situation is currently for folks, and are there any people left outside from the original Pajaro group that are still at the, I guess it's the campground in Watsonville that the Pajaro people moved to, the parking lot that served as a sort of emergency shelter area?
Yeah, the warming center that did for Lot 18. You know, the two-day, five-day, it's until January 4 at this point. For some people, I don't know. You know, everyone's getting a different deal. Depends on what day you showed up, apparently. Or when they actually decided to distribute vouchers to begin with, you know. The city manager, I guess there was a meeting this morning, yesterday morning at 11 o'clock, and city manager decided to take the day off. Didn't show up, you know, for the meeting, which is kind of frustrating.
Who called for the meeting? Was it the city manager or the people who are in the group of refugees?
Well, the 28th was a specific date that Councilmember Garcia mentioned, so I'm starting to think it's yesterday. I'd have to look it up to be sure.
Well, yesterday was the 28th.
Well, there was a meeting on homelessness. It was one of the subjects. I don't know what it was with. It was county, city. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But city manager, I suppose, was supposed to be a part of that meeting and was not there.
Was this a meeting with the public, or was it a meeting privately with the interested?
No, it was a public meeting. I don't know what agency. You know, it might be the Continuum. I don't even know. But it was alluded to in the Potteronian earlier in the month. I don't know the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the wrong county. I didn't go.
Well, you did all that you wanted.
I've been on the ground. Potter Rising, man, those folks have just been phenomenal. Nothing but love and support and finances. You know, I mean, they've been able to raise an awful lot of money. You can pay for hotel rooms that the city should be paying for, or the Monterey County, whatever, whoever you want to claim, you know, get stuck with a bill. Shouldn't be us, that's for sure.
Who is Pajaro Rising? What are you talking about?
Well, the folks that are supporting the Warming Center, you know, that was on Lot 18 for a minute. Same folks that were supporting the Pajaro River homeless community. It's the name we're going by on Instagram.
I see. So these are folks from Monterey and Santa Cruz County who've kind of come out, who've been documenting, who've been providing not just money.
More or less from Watsonville, and a few from outside of Watsonville.
Uh-huh. A lot of people that you never knew before, or mostly folks you were familiar with?
Folks that I've met over the last 6-8 months or something.
Uh-huh. And are they... You're praising them. Does this mean you have a sense that there's a coherent group that's like...
Absolutely. Yes, a very coherent group, and they've been very, very active, very supportive, and very direct. It's been, like I said, phenomenal. Yes, they did raise a lot of money, like, you know, so that's how come, like, the Warming Center had just basically all brand new stuff, a few kickdowns from other in the community, and so we were wrapping it up, you know, and being able to take it with us, because, you know, we're going to have to catch these folks again if the city relents.
Have you visited, by that you mean if the city regresses and goes back on its promises?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, have you visited any of the Pajaro refugees in their new digs?
I've not visited them lately. They got in like on the 23rd, maybe. Somewhere in there, 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
The city was closed, but they still showed up anyway, which was good because they were about to ditch them for the whole weekend.
Now, you've been kind of going back and forth between Salinas and Seaside Marina area, pretty much. Any reports on how folks are doing who were ousted from the parking lot at the, the Seaside or Marina, the supervisor's parking lot there, who are in their vans, and one of whom was dragged off to arrested and actually injured, as that was described to me, and others who are... you know, struggling to find places in cities that criminalize just living in your RV during the day.
Yes. Well, I have heard a few people have lost their rigs, and one gal was actually struck by another car just sleeping at 6 in the morning. So that is definitely a concern, you know, just for having a place, and now it's hurting more of an eyesore. Now you got to repair the hole in there, especially with the rain and everything. People are in a lot worse situation.
Now, it's kind of cold over here in Santa Cruz County. That was one of the concerns that Brent Adams expressed, that more so than the rain, which is continuing, but not in perhaps the same volume that it came down a week ago, but that it's gotten a lot colder on and off. How's the weather impacting people in homeless situations, either, you know, in Salinas or in Monterey or in anywhere in areas that you've been covering?
Well, I mean, you know, the flooding issue, I think, has been more important. I mean, if you can't hunker down, stay dry, you can't stay warm. That's been a big issue, I guess, is the muddiness of the situation. Some places are actually, I mean, what we're really trying to do, I guess, at this point, is try to drive up a little bit more organized space, you know, encampments, grid, civically engineered, so there's enough room for the ambulance to get through and everything. So people have actually been widening their space. spots or whatever, you know, so that there's enough room. So the ground is pretty clear. So at least there's that. I mean, you know, unless you stay dry, you can't stay warm. And that, I think a lot of people have stuff. It's just a matter of keeping it dry because, you know, once it gets wet, it's pretty well toast. You can't really use it anymore.
Yeah, that's certainly been some of the concerns that people have had over here in Santa Cruz. No question. Anything on the horizon with the homeless union in other cities that you know about that, you know, in terms of lawsuits or in terms of negotiations with city managers, city councils, city attorneys, county authorities, and so forth?
I don't know for sure. I mean, I pay a little bit of attention to Sausalito and Chico and Fresno. There goes through a lot of major throws there. At least Sausalito and Fresno, for sure, they're a little bit more struggle. That one dude, Jeremy, I can't remember his last name, but Black Lever Productions, I think.
Okay, say that again, could you?
Police brutality. This guy, Jeremy, was beat up with Robbie Palliston.
Oh, right, the photographer, yeah. Yeah, it was. I was reading in the paper today an article from the Marin IJ, the so-called main newspaper there, the establishment paper, that DA and the police department have dropped charges against him. Of course, you know, the real issue is why aren't they being charged, but...
Yeah, since they're now exonerating him, shouldn't the others be arrested for false imprisonment and brutality and everything? I mean, where are those charges?
So you have I know you've been closed-mouthed about it, but you have a case coming up yourself. What's that? It's an arraignment? It's a pretrial? Where is it? If people want to be supportive...
It's first appearance, as far as I know. Yes, I don't know. It's at 1:30 on the 6th. In Salinas, I don't know which department, and then you know, I'm hoping that I can use some of their same arguments. Actually, that's one of the reasons I've been following them a little bit close. But you know, one thing was they had to get a warrant, you know, to be able to search his video footage, and so I want to see if that warrant has already been done or if there's a way I can block it. But you know,
they're still holding your footage.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, I would think they should be able to look at it because, like I said, you know, it's journalistic work, and you know, and you know, privacy issue. So you know, on the real issue, and plus it's got both all five of us, you know, all of us, and to some degree with exonerated, and to another degree they got no business even looking at it. So I don't even think they should have access to it. And then once they do, they're going to realize that they didn't wish they had the access because they're going to have less go. So, you know, Sasha should have never got the guy to recover. That was wrong. And then the three that were in front of the police, you know, they were fully justified because the judge sided with us and granted the TRO. You know, and for myself, you know, it's going to reveal that I was just documenting.
And for those who haven't heard this before, this concerned an incident where actually I was there right before this happened. It was in the Pajaro River where you and others and myself as well were encouraging the police and other people who were trying to, and who did in fact demolish a number of campsites allegedly to clean up the river, even though there was a TRO pending. That is to say, it either had been filed or was in the process of being filed, and it was it looked like the city or the county authorities or whether it was the fish and game or whatever the hell was doing it.
No, it's Monterey County.
Monterey County was trying to kind of move in and quickly destroy, demoralize, and disperse homeless encampments before the actual TRO got granted, which it did the next day. And you got arrested, and so did three, I guess, or you say four others got arrested, is that right?
Well, no, three. three in one instance and myself in another instance.
Right, the one woman in
Sasha the week before that.
In the parking lot when they were driving away people from the marina supervisor's lot.
She was walking into her home, her RV. Nobody else was impeded from entering the rig except her. And that was complete targeting of a disabled woman of color. That's, you know, about three different strikes on these guys.
Are they going to, all these cases going to be to arraignment on the same day, or?
For myself and the other three, yes. For Sasha, it should have been before that. I don't even know if it already happened or not. I can find her, you know, because the only way they do records is if the case has already been heard, then they file the minutes. So, it's active right now. It's just starting, so I don't get to know, you know.
Well, if you want to find out, all you have to do is go to the court and look under her name and see where it's slated for. I mean, that's the way
to do it. Right. No, that's why I went to the records department and looked up her name and date of birth. And, it didn't appear. Well, because it's not in the minutes yet. We're about to go to court to have court minutes. So there are no court minutes to find.
Well, you don't look in the court minutes. You go to the court clerk and you say, are there any hearings scheduled for this person? That's what you do.
Yes. Yeah, I know. That's what I'm going to try to do next.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Well,
it might already have happened or just about to happen or something.
So you have a case coming up yourself, and it's going to be, you're going to enter a plea? Is that the plan? And we'll hear more, but not a lot more, about Wes's case after this musical interlude. And it's another one by David Rovix. It's called Cordova, and here's what he writes about it. On August 20th, 1993, the people of the fishing community of Cordova, Alaska, initiated a blockade of Prince William Sound. For 3 days and nights, their line of boats stretched across the water and prevented oil tankers from coming in or getting out. It had been 4 years since the Exxon Valdez oil tanker catastrophe, enough time to find out whether the herring run would recover. It didn't. Outraged at the whole situation and the lack of accountability of the Exxon Corporation for the damage caused to the fishing industry and the environment, the people of Cordova took this daring action. They only ended the blockade after the Secretary of the Interior got on a boat and came out to talk to them. He agreed to fund research into the toxicity of oil. He followed through on this promise, and the definitive conclusion of the researchers was that oil is, in fact, very, very toxic.
I am a fisherman. So were my parents. Here in Cordova, on Prince William Sound, I'm not a tree hugger, but I love the mountains. And hauling in the gill net with the ocean all around, life was good here. You could raise a family with 100,000 tons of herring set out every year. 1989, the tanker grounded. Nothing has ever been the same around here. Senator Stevens said, not one drop of oil would spill on Alaska's shores, and if it happened, it would be cleaned up. But our beaches were still covered, as was the ocean floor. 4 years passed, each run collapsed. It was then we knew for sure the herring weren't coming back. Exxon's promises of compensation were about as empty as a used up paper sack. August 20th, 1993, when we fishermen decided something must be done. We packed some groceries, we made some banners, we headed out to Valdez Narrows beneath the midnight sun. 100 vessels took to the water, pushed through a storm and to the Valdez Sea. We lined up our boats, formed a blockade, and waited for whatever might be. was approaching. It was a sight to see there in the twilight of the day. We saw it turning. We all cheered and cried as tanker after tanker after tanker turned away. A Coast Guard gunship from Seattle would take 3 days to get up to the sound. We held the line till then we went back home to Cordova, to this hallowed oiled ground. I am a fisherman, so were my parents. Here in Cordova, on Prince William Sound.
It's a good idea. Well,
it might already have happened, or just about to happen, or something.
So you have a case coming up yourself, and it's going to be what? Is this just you're going to enter a plea? Is that the plan?
Probably.
And what?
Yeah.
That's going to be 1:30 on what day for anybody who wants to observe your crucifixion?
January 6th, all four of us. Yeah, January 6th. It'll be a very quick procedure. But yeah, no support is fine. And curiosity is fine, you know, but this is going to be a process, definitely a process. They're not going to give up, you know, right on the first bat. So,
and they might hold you there for quite a while. That is, so you may be sitting in the court for hours, and they may call your case last. So bring a good book and be prepared to have them say, you can't read that newspaper in court, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, right. I can't see what you're doing behind that newspaper.
Yeah. All right. Well, so 1:30. Do you know the department?
Being in high school again.
You know the department? I guess people should just go look on the court calendar.
Salinas Courthouse. Yeah, it'll be in the Salinas Courthouse.
Salinas Courthouse, and look for Wes White on the court calendar, right?
Yeah, and then there's three of us. We all have the same case number.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your kind of giving me this. It's vacation time and there's not a lot happening. I'm glad that, I guess, it sounds like people from your account, people from the Watsonville scene are inside as a consequence of a lot of activism that they were doing and supporters were doing and that you were doing and others were doing. And so they would be getting fucking drenched and be demoralized outside and dispersed if it hadn't been for that particular organizing effort and that out front protest, actually, is what it was.
Yes.
That's how I look at it, as, again, from a distant perspective. I don't know. Any word from...
That's fairly true. That's the whole point, is trying to get more people involved in the process. And, the mutual aid sector is where it's at right now.
Right on. Any word from Chico and how that's going?
They're maintaining. I think it's just maintaining more or less. But Comanche Creek is flooding and everything, just like everywhere else. And so they're just having a hard time servicing people. But there again, this is all like DSA and mutual aid and just people who have a heart. I mean, that's really, more people get involved in the process, then they're, there's nothing really, it's a problem solved themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's been good. I mean, they've learned a lot, and I think a much stronger community for it. And, last thing they want to see them is on that airport tarmac. So I think they're still just at Comanche Creek. I'm not even sure there's been, just like Camp Compassion. Camp Compassion, I don't think, has had to move either.
Camp Compassion is, what is that, we're talking Novato, or?
In Novato, yes.
Mm-hmm. I know, I just got a call from Petaluma, too, from Monica Martella. I spoke with her.
Oh, okay.
She isn't in the encampment. She's housed herself, but she has connections with it, and she was kind of giving a report. I don't have a lot clarity on it, but it's good to hear from people that people trying to make connections with each other, I think, is the way to go. So.
Right. Well, who knows? Well, maybe we can learn from each other. Maybe our bit of information will work in a different jurisdiction and stop penetrating, making that precedent. that can actually be like, even everyone knows what a better working model would look like. It's just they're the first ones to actually accept trying to do it.
You're here.
Well, I don't know. We keep on pushing, and one way or another, even the judge, you know, the judge was I love that hearing, you know, because she's like, oh, okay. I think this might have been the Monterey County case. You know, there's a trail to be continued still. And she's like, okay, so what are you citing, you know, to get rid of these people anyway? Oh, we have an ordinance. Oh, okay, well then how long would it take for something to get on the agenda? And then, well, maybe 2 Mondays or something. So that's been a pressure point, which is good. You know, because really it is about changing the policy and then creating that policy to be a better and best practice or to be used. When do we actually care about people? Because look at all the money we spend on law enforcement and getting rid of people, and yet we just still have to deal with the same people again. How come we don't just improve the way we do things? Why are we doing this insanity still? It's an addiction. This is an addiction. Doing sweeps and getting paid to be mean to people. Some kind of mean-spirited addiction.
Any, of course, I always point out that the groups that you and I are dealing with are often very small or much smaller groups than the broader general homeless population in any of these cities. Any word on what's been happening generally in Salinas or generally in Seaside or generally in Watsonville? Any changes there? Any sense of any of that?
Salinas is trying to make it somebody else's problem. CHP has been driving people off the highway. They did clear a lot of people off the train tracks. And seriously, though, but where do you go, man? It's like you can't. They're not trying to solve anything. What they're trying to do is make money, you know, for treating people poorly and pretending to say they're helping you.
And Seaside or Marina or Monterey?
Oh God, no changes yet. Unfortunately, I mean, you know, they're decent with it. Yeah, the tollway stuff has been pretty painful for people. You know. I don't know, man. There's people that are already having a hard time. You know, they're not all there, some of them. And they're not having that community anymore. I'm thinking Marina, close to the parking lot quite a bit. And, you know, there's about three ladies that lost their rig. There's a lot of people with tickets that, you know, the county said that they were going to, whatever, bump up $1,500 for parts or registration, but they weren't able to get anything on that because it was pretty well a secret. And, you know, other than the dude that was doing the auto parts, but the registration was never a high priority. You know, so, of course, that's limiting them. And, of course, repairs for to be able to pass the smog. So it's been a pain and very disappointing.
Any indication of the increasing likelihood of vax mandates for vaccine for the various COVID threats that are ballyhooed more increasingly in the...
The spring shelter in Salinas actually got COVID positive and kept everybody in there. I don't know if that is still, you know, but I think they're still, you know, locked down on it.
But by positive, do you mean people were actually sick or they just tested positive?
Somebody tested positive, and I don't know if they were sick, deathly ill, or any of that. But because of that, they locked down the building, and everyone had to remain inside.
Is there any concern from civil liberties advocates about this, how these vaccine mandates are affecting homeless people in any of the areas you've been keeping an eye on?
No, that's been a low-level burner. The mask mandate, half the county don't even want to respect it anyway. The county administration. It's not a big deal to them.
So the administration isn't pressing to demand people's ID and demand that people show their proof of vaccination, including homeless people, if they enter a public area?
I do know that some places do. I don't know if... I don't know which ones. Mm-hmm.
Well, I appreciate your, you know, trying to, you know, give me as much as you can know about the various things, issues, questions I'm raising. Anything that I have not covered that you want to mention?
Again, the city manager was trying to get us to come in for, talk about future stuff. And
which city?
How are we going to work together? City Salinas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how are we going to work together? So we were actually slated for a meeting last month, but that's when I went to Idaho. So River went instead of Rita and I. And, I guess they didn't really get a really good impression on the experience. And, that, it's like, well, were you able to record it at least? And, he asked not to, so was it insisted upon? And then I guess I insisted upon it. And,
good for you.
What's the point in having a conversation if it's not going to be on the record? I mean, homie's working, and he's crying about his privacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, he could, invite you to a private tete-a-tete cozy supper, and then you could all be very private.
Oh, sure.
And you can get a meal out of it. Well, listen, thank you.
Basically, accusing them of co-opting us and, trying to manipulate us, so.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Wes. I'm going to grab myself a cup of coffee or maybe a cup of cocoa. I guess it's going to be that time of night.
There you go.
Yeah. Good luck. In court, don't take it too seriously, even though it's, full of shit. And as, courts can be very depressing. I always find one thing to do is try to interview people who are there for other reasons. You get some sense of what's really going on, and you can turn it into an opportunity to educate people. That's one thing you might consider. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. Well, some people think I'm going to prison, and I'm like, who told you that? And, of course, they'll never tell me. So I say, okay, well, then, it's on a misdemeanor? Really? Really? That's what you believe is going to happen to me? You guys aren't very bright. But, I should definitely be able to get this. We should all be able to get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, use it as an opportunity to get some information from other folks, and I will grill you on it when I next talk to you.
All right. Okay, we'll try.
Hey, thank you, guys. I'm going to read to you now from the San Francisco Chronicle of December 26th, the Sunday edition, from Justin Phillips' column. It's headed Get Tough Stance, Part of Mayor's Playbook. And he's writing about the San Francisco Mayor London Breed. Here's what he writes. When San Francisco Mayor London Breed announced that bringing more aggressive policing to the Tenderloin would be part of her plan to fix the bulls that has destroyed our city, conservative media claimed that the moment marked by an ideological shift by a major defund politician. In their told you so euphoria, the truth was either swept aside or willfully ignored. Breed's comments weren't some kind of course correction. Instead, they were a return to form for the reform-light, police-friendly mayor, and a sign that she is leading the city back down a familiar and potentially flawed path. Breed made her feelings about traditional policing known before her 2012 election. That's the 2012 election, to the city's Board of Supervisors, where she said on a candidate questionnaire that year that she supported expanding foot patrols in the city. The San Francisco Police Officers Association returned the love by endorsing her candidacy. When Breed wasn't advocating for more officers, she was often reluctant to criticize them publicly. After the 2014 killing of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old black man who was shot by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, protests against police brutality swept the country. Breed helped vote down a Board of Supervisors resolution of support for the movement, saying at the time that San Francisco was, quote, not Ferguson. 2 years later, Breed, by then president of the Board of Supervisors, largely stayed silent as the national policing debate came home. At that point, the San Francisco Police Department was under intense scrutiny over the fatal shooting of Mario Woods in 2015 and Louis Gongora in 2016, as well as public outcry over text messages exchanged among officers where they used racist and homophobic slurs to criticize African Americans, Latinos, Indians, and the LGBTQ community. That May, police fatally shot Jessica Williams, 29, an unarmed black woman whom police accused of trying to flee in a stolen vehicle, culminating in Police Chief Greg Suhr's resignation. Unlike her colleagues on the board, some of whom called for Suhr's resignation and some of whom defended him, Breed declined to take a stance. Because of the city's charter, Breed made the leap from president of the Board of Supervisors to acting mayor in 2017 after the death of Mayor Ed Lee. She was formally elected to the position in the summer of 2018. In her inauguration speech, Breed pledged to add hundreds of officers to the city's police force with the goal of addressing the same kind of crimes she's now decrying in the Tenderloin. Improving police relations in communities of color got only a passing mention. The idea that Breed was a defund mayor first emerged last summer when she introduced a plan to redistribute $120 million in law enforcement spending over 2 years to black neighborhoods. It was a rare moment in her political career where she spoke about cops in a way that resonated more with reformers and police abolitionists than with police unions. But it didn't take long for Breed to revert to form. Her proposed budget for next year would deliver $689 million to the police department if adopted, which is just $3 million shy of the department's all-time high in 2019-2020. And this month, Breed called for more police to receive even more overtime spending and expanded access to surveillance footage as part of her crackdown on theft and drug use in the Tenderloin. Breed's critics, including elected officials and local activists, say the mayor should focus on investing in treatment, education, and housing rather than policing as a response to deep-rooted social crises. During a recent trip to the area, Breed told media that the city is going to enforce every single law at our disposal to get drug users either into treatment or, sadly, the alternative is jail. The mayor described her approach as, quote, tough love. But even with the projected spring opening of a supervised drug use site, which isn't a bad idea in my view, there isn't enough treatment to go around. That's my view, Robert's view, not Justin Phillips' view. Just 2 years ago, the city's health department identified nearly 4,000 San Francisco residents who faced homelessness, mental illness, and addiction, the Chronicle reported. A city plan to add 400 treatment beds to the existing 2,200 is still underway, which means police could be saddled with responding to the Tenderloin's very public struggles with addiction and mental health issues and to the city's less visible battle with an abject shortage of social services. We've seen this movie before. America's war on drugs resulted in militarized police departments with bloated budgets that drained city finances. It also drove mass incarceration, the effects of which we're still living with today. Black people make up 5% of San Francisco's population, yet 48% of its jail population, according to a 2020 report from the DA's office. 80% of the people booked into the jail in 2018 reported substance abuse. Gun-toting foot patrols can't address the root of Tenderloin's problems. But they can appease a base of voters who equate police presence with safety. And they can remind us who London Breed, the mayor of San Francisco, has always been. And I read this story not because I'm terribly interested in San Francisco, though I have an interest in it, but because I think it really can be used to shine a light on Santa Cruz, where you have similar politicians who are talking now about, don't use the words defund, use the words reform. And you have situations like the then-mayor Justin Cummings, African-American guy, whom I've called repeatedly an Uncle Tom for doing this and for his other moves to criminalize homeless people and to ignore a coalition that was once in place on the city council and run instead, or should we say gravitate instead, to the Cynthia Matthews, Donna Myers, Martine Watkins coalition, which is running the city now. So let's have a brief musical break here, and then we'll get back to whatever I can find. Here's another one by David Rovix, and it looks like the song is called From Kabul to Khartoum. Sanctions on Iraq had been going on for many years, causing the untimely deaths of hundreds of thousands of predominantly Iraq Muslim men, women, and children. But when the USS Cole was attacked, the Western media painted the event as if an innocent U.S. Navy ship was attacked by crazed, bearded Muslims because they hate our freedom. And then the Clinton administration's military assaults in Afghanistan and Sudan on August 21, 1998, that followed were painted as, quote, retaliation. Of course, by definition, the U.S. and the U.K., Israel, France, etc., are always retaliating, never initiating. The bombing of the pharmaceutical factory in the Sudan had a devastating effect on the entire region, since there was no way for the government of Sudan to replace the loss of the drugs that the factory had been producing.
The deaths of thousands of innocent people in New York and Washington. The thing is that I think it's true for many of us here. We've been mourning the deaths of people for a long time. And those who ask why such a horrible thing would happen haven't been to Iraq. From Guatemala to Korea, to the tunnels beneath Hanoi, from Tulsa to El Chorizo, fat man to little boy. We fought them in Nicaragua and upon the Cuban shore. Killed Gaddafi's daughter, see what the fatwa's got in store. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From Kabul to Khartoum, where Allah's martyrs bled, to the Iraqi desert, 200,000 people dead. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see?
And that song ends rather abruptly. I think it's a defect in the recording. So instead I'm going to play New Orleans, which is described as follows. As Camp Casey was being dismantled, and that's a camp by Cindy Sheehan in honor of her son Casey killed in Iraq. She started the camp in August 6, 2005 outside George Bush's ranch, President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. She wanted to ask Bush why her son had died. He wouldn't answer the phone call, so she thought she'd pay him a personal visit, but he wouldn't open the gate to this ranch either. As Camp Casey was being dismantled in Texas in preparation for Cindy Sheehan and others to go on a speaking tour around the U.S., Hurricane Katrina struck the coast of Louisiana and Alabama on August 28, 2005. Soon the rainfall would overwhelm the decrepit, neglected infrastructure in the city of New Orleans, flooding the city. The worst was yet to come, as federal, state, and municipal authorities were all utterly incapable of dealing effectively or even rationally with the situation. As soldiers prevented people from trying to help those dying in flooded neighborhoods, as vigilantes shot, quote, looters for, quote, stealing essential supplies from flooded shops in an abandoned city, thousands died and continue to die in the water, in attics, and on rooftops across the city. Cuban aid was offered and rejected.
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear. The future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, 'cause otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding just a little more so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said. Now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted. Inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be seen. But Washington decided instead they should be mean. 'Cause malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. New Orleans, New Orleans. Years and years of warning, no evacuation plan. It was just that the waters rose. Get out if you can. There were no buses. No one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who wouldn't be. All the people with no money. All the people with no wheels. All of those who couldn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state. Abandoned by their country. Just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Sad and awful days when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water. They died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Now the city is massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. Half a million refugees. Here we are in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth. Where oil is the king. Where global warming is ignored. Where the very end of life is the place we're heading towards. Where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. And if we don't stop this madness, the whole world will be like New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans.
And here's a story from yesterday's December 29th Mercury News. No, it's the Sentinel. Family remembers 14-year-old's dreams before LAPD shooting by Stephanie Dazio and Christopher Weber. This is the AP story from Los Angeles. The 14-year-old girl who was killed by the Los Angeles police last week, she was struck while hiding in a dressing room as an officer was aiming rifle rounds at a man suspected of assaulting customers at a clothing store. And a bullet went through a wall, loved skateboarding, and had dreams of becoming an engineer to build robots, her family said Tuesday. Valentina Orellana Peralta died in her mother's arms last Thursday after the pair had spent the morning shopping for Christmas clothes at a Burlington store in the North Hollywood neighborhood in the San Leandro Valley. The teen's family stood outside the LAPD headquarters next to a large photo of Orellana Peralta wreathed in flowers to call for justice and remember their daughter. Speaking in Spanish and choking back tears as sirens wailed in the background of the news conference in downtown L.A., they said they had left Chile to get away from the violence and injustice in search of a better life in the U.S. The LAPD on Monday posted an edited video package online that included 9/11 calls, radio transmissions, body camera footage, and surveillance video from the Thursday shooting at a Burlington store crowded with holiday shoppers. The department's policy is to release video from critical events, such as police shootings, within 45 days. I guess selective parts of videos might be better said. The family's attorneys, including civil rights attorney Ben Crump, have sent a letter to the LAPD asking for more video. Surveillance video showed the suspect attacking two women, including one who fell to the floor before he dragged her by her feet through the store's aisles as she tried to crawl away. Multiple people, including store employees, called police to report a man striking customers with a bike lock at the store in the North Hollywood area of the San Fernando Valley. One caller told a 911 dispatcher that the man had a gun. No firearm, only the bike lock, was recovered at the scene. The early surveillance footage showed a man carrying a bicycle up the store's escalator to the second floor, where he wandered around, seemingly disoriented, clutching a cable-style bike lock. At times, he stood motionless, staring into the distance. The footage later showed the man on the down escalator attacking a woman who managed to escape his grip and run out of the store. The man then left the store for a minute and a half, police said. After he returned, according to the video, he repeatedly beat a woman with a bike lock while she cowered on the floor. As she tried to escape, he dragged her through the aisle toward the dressing room. Orellana Peralta's mother, Soledad Peralta, said they were in a dressing room shopping for Christmas clothes when they heard screaming. The teenager locked the door and they got onto the floor and prayed together. In body cam video, armed officers entered the store and approached the suspect. One held a rifle and pushed to the front of the pack as the officers went through the store in formation. Other officers repeatedly said, "Slow down and slow it down," as the officer with the rifle moves forward. "She's bleeding," an officer shouted as they encountered the victim crawling on the bloodstained floor. The suspect was on the other side of the aisle. "Hold up, hold up," another officer screamed just before three shots rang out. The officer holding the rifle fired, police said. The 22-year-old suspect, Daniel Elena Lopez, died at the scene. Soledad Peralta's screams can be heard in the video. At this preliminary stage of the investigation, it is believed that the victim was struck by one of the rounds fired by an officer at the suspect, Police Captain Stacy Spell said in the posted video. Police believe the bullet skipped off the floor and struck the dressing room wall. "The investigation is just beginning, and it could take up to a year or more to complete," Spell said. The California Department of Justice is also investigating, so by that time, hopefully, we'll have forgotten all about it, right? "We at the LAPD would like to express our most heartfelt condolences and profound regret for the loss of this innocent victim, Valentina Orellana Peralta. There are no words that can describe the depth of the sorrow we feel at this tragic outcome," Spell said in the video. LAPD officers have shot people, 38 people, 18 of them fatally, including the shooting Sunday of a man with a knife in 2021, according to the LA Times. These figures mark a dramatic rise in cases where officers shot or killed people in either of the last 2 years. Mourners left flowers and a votive candle outside the store on Christmas in a memorial for Orellana Peralta. Her family said she earned good grades, even though English was her second language, and she'd only been in the U.S. for about 6 months. Her father, Juan Pablo Orellana Larenas, held up a brand new skateboard still in its plastic wrapping that his doctor had ordered online, but died before she could ride it. The Times reported that Elena Lopez's previous criminal history includes convictions for car theft, carrying a loaded gun in public, and carrying a gun as a felon. He was transferred to the L.A. County Jail to the custody of the state prison system, but a spokeswoman for the Corrections Department would not release his commitment history to the newspaper because of the LAPD investigation. Isn't that convenient? The woman who was assaulted had moderate to serious injuries, including wounds to her head, arms, and face. She has not been named publicly. LAPD officers who also killed a bystander in 2018 during a gunfight with a suspect at a Trader Joe's market. Police fatally shot and killed Melita Corrado, 27, the assistant store manager, as she ran toward the store's entrance. Prosecutors found that two police officers acted lawfully when they returned the suspect's gunfire. That's a story in the Santa Cruz Sentinel from December 29th. Family remembers 14-year-old's dreams before LAPD shooting. And here's a Mercury News story, opinion, actually, in the editorial page of Sunday, December 26th. It's time to stop coddling police in the Golden State. Once again, police records released under a three-year-old state law call into question the ongoing practices of a Bay Area law enforcement agency. This time, the city is Richmond, where it turns out police dogs bite more frequently than in New York City, which has 80 times the population, Chicago, or Washington, D.C. From 2014 through 19, there were 73 Richmond cases in which police dogs caused significant injury, an average of more than one a month. More than 80% of people bitten by police in Richmond were either hiding or running from police. More than 60% were found unarmed. When race was noted in police reports, more than half of those bitten were black, although they make up only 20% of Richmond's population. And in some cases, Julia Pratisuluk and Harriet Blair Rowan of the Bay Area News Group reported last weekend the dogs attacked the wrong person. Victims included a retired police officer from Mexico who was visiting family and sleeping in their shed. He wasn't the man suspected of assaulting his wife, whom cops were seeking. A teenager walking home from school. He wasn't the car thief being sought. And even a Richmond police officer attacked in the department's parking lot. As in too many police records cases across the state, the Richmond dog bite incident came only to light after litigation forced the city to turn over the documents. This news organization and its media partners had to go to court to shake free the records. Now, suddenly, Richmond officials are expressing alarm at the findings of frequent police dog bites in their community. They should also be asked why they fought disclosure of the records for so long. As I have found in Santa Cruz, the police are very reluctant to release their records. Even under the wonderfully cooperative Andy Mills, as some people see him, the former police chief. Now, suddenly, Richmond officials are expressing alarm. Despite the growing push for law enforcement accountability, public officials who oversee California police departments, often elected after professing concern for reining in excessive law enforcement practices, repeatedly circle the wagons to protect their cops from transparency. It's time for those officials to get on the right side of this struggle. They can't reform their police departments if they shield them from public review. Simply put, police reform begins with transparency. A few elected officials, most notably San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo, get this. Until he stepped up, his police department had been stonewalling, and this organization had been forced to launch legal action. The records that were finally released revealed that San Jose police officers rarely faced discipline in cases where they inflicted serious injuries on civilians. Police records disclosures elsewhere were similarly disturbing. A veteran investigator for the California Department of Consumer Affairs had been stealing thousands of rounds of ammunition and other items for decades. A Walnut Creek officer repeatedly falsified reports but kept his job. A Sonoma County Sheriff's correctional deputy who fondled and kissed a female inmate under his guard avoided criminal charges. Domestic violence complaints against an officer living in the Central Valley town of Sanger were ignored. And as revealed in reporting by a collaboration of California newsrooms, more than 80 law enforcement officers working in California were convicted criminals with rap sheets that include everything from animal cruelty to manslaughter. For decades, police in California enjoyed wide-reaching protections against disclosure of their misbehavior. Then, in 2018, state lawmakers approved Senate Bill 1421, legislation authored by State Senator Nancy Skinner, Democrat of Berkeley, that started to pry open the door on police records. The law now requires police agencies to release documents pertaining to cops' discharge of firearms, use of major force, sexual assault, and dishonesty. Starting January 1st, thanks to the passage this year of Skinner's SB 16, police agencies will also have to disclose records of unreasonable force, racist or biased behavior, and unlawful searches or arrests. This, of course, is what I've been trying to get around homeless issues for 3 years without success. Well, actually, I would say that most recently I've been trying to get it for 3 months without success. But I've had problems throughout this period of Andy Mills and previously Chief Vogel's tenure here in Santa Cruz getting records. Simply require that I keep repeating the request again and again. And I find that if you do so in a way that documents what you're doing, eventually you may get further, though there's no guarantee of that. You eventually may have to take it to court. I've never done that, but that has become a possibility. SB 16 will also require police misconduct records be disclosed within 45 days of a document request, although public agencies will have until January 1st, 2023 to make public the newly disclosable records, for instance, that occurred before 2022. But since the passage of SB 1421, police agencies across the state, including Oakland and Contra Costa County, have dragged their feet, according to an analysis by a coalition of media organizations known as the California Reporting Project. More than 173 agencies representing 84% of the state's sworn officers have failed to fully respond to requests for use of force records. The stalling has proved costly to taxpayers in cases where local governments are finally forced into legal submission. Contra Costa County paid out $380,000 in legal fees. Richmond paid out $225,000. San Jose coughed up $65,000. When government agencies were first confronted with record requests under SB 1421, they complained of the volume and the uncertainty of what must be disclosed. They've now had 3 years to work out the workflow kinks, and courts across the state have clarified many of the key issues of dispute. The time for excuses is over. Government officials must decide whether they want to reform their police departments or protect bad cops. And, of course, to ask the question is usually to answer it in this case. I mean, the city of Santa Cruz spent over $100,000 because they refused to change rules that were eventually clarified by the California Supreme Court in the so-called mock Nazi salute case that you may remember I've talked about occasionally on the air back in 2002 when I was arrested for a silent gesture indicating my feeling that the city council was acting like a bunch of fascists in shutting down oral communication in direct violation of Christopher Crone, then mayor's, promises. Yes, that's the liberal Christopher Crone, the guy who got recalled. I guess in some ways he's gotten better. In some ways, it's really hard for people who are in political positions to get better unless they're willing to risk their political position. And very few people who spend the time, energy, and money to get there are. Partially maybe because they're idealistic and they think they can do a lot of good if only they can stay, make some compromises. And then partially because they're ambitious. Let's have a musical break. Well, an educational as well as musical break, since this is more David Rovics. On August 4th, 2011, a black Londoner named Mark Dugan was shot by police while sitting in the seat of a car. Fiery rebellion in every major English city soon followed. These periodic urban rebellions in places full of inequality like England and the United States are never predicated on only one particular event, really. Rather, the events that set off the uprising are simply representative of the general way people feel like when they are treated by the police or some other aspect of the power structure. Other examples include urban uprisings in England in the 1980s and rebellions throughout the United States in 1991.
Sitting in his car, they say he might have had a gun. What we know for sure is he had 5 kids, daughters and sons. Now he can't have a family, he'll never
see his friends. His neighbors understand what kind of message this sends. Some life is worth less, some life is worth more. You don't have to be a mathematician to know the score. Some people get shot just for being who they are. Some people play with iPads, take vacations, drive in fancy cars. Some people go to university, some people do not. It depends on where you're born and how much money you got. The government cuts their spending, widening the divide, and reacts with disbelief when they face the rising tide of anger at the cuts, at the futures that they rob. With each day, so many have to live without a job. If the riots asked the question, then this was his reply. We'll arrest these hooligans, these people without shame. They are only criminals, and it's only criminals to blame. Morals have decayed among the peasants' ranks, so let us lock them up while we bail out the banks. When that's the way they look at it, it's not very hard to watch things fall apart in this house of cards. Now the flames are getting hotter. Kids have too much freedom, and all this is just a sign that we need more policemen. Teach them to respect. Well, if that's your line, then I know just what you can expect. The class will be repeated until the lesson has been learned. All you need is some injustice to make your cities burn. All you need is the perception, whether or not it's true, that most of us will never live the way you do. Now the flames are getting hotter. Any coming to your town? London is burning down.
And just in case you didn't catch the lyrics, because I didn't, some of them, here they are. The cop shot another man. They have that kind of knack. And it may not be coincidental that he was black. He was sitting in his car. They say he might have had a gun. What we know for sure is he had five kids, daughters and sons. Now he cannot have a family. He'll never see his friends. His neighbors understand what kind of message this sends. Some life is worth less, some life is worth more. You don't have to be a mathematician to know the score. Some people get shot for being who they are. Some people play with iPads and drive in fancy cars. Some people go to college and others ones do not. It depends on how much money you got. The government cuts their spending, widening the divide, then reacts with disbelief when they face the tide of anger at the cuts of the futures that they rob. With each day, so many have to live without a job. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning down. Cameron went on TV in his suit and tie. If the riots asked a question, then this was his reply. We'll arrest these hooligans, these people without shame. They are only criminals, and it's criminals to blame. Morals have decayed among the peasants' ranks, so let's lock them up while we bail out the banks. When that's the way they look at it, it's not very hard to watch things fall apart in this house of cards. You can flip through all the channels, hear clueless people whine. These kids have too much freedom, and all this is just a sign that we need more policemen to teach them some respect. Well, if that's your line, then I know just what you can expect. The class will be repeated until the lesson has been learned. All you need is some injustice to make your cities burn. All you need is the perception, whether or not it's true, that most of us will never live the way that you do. And now let's listen to an interview with Monica Martella, who's a Petaluma woman who's been homeless and has been keeping a close eye on the homeless situation. We had her on the net and in the archives a couple of months ago. Here she is again. Petaluma is a city which now has an injunction protecting some of the homeless folks in at least one of the camps. And here's Monica to talk about the situation there. However, I'm realizing it might be good to give some background, and although I'm wary of establishment background, I haven't yet been able to make contact with or taken the trouble to make contact with the Petaluma attorneys and plaintiffs involved in this case. So here's the Argus Courier staff story from December 23rd. I think it's the Press Democrat. Yeah, it's the Press Democrat, and apparently Amelia Pereira, whose byline is the Argus Courier staff, is writing for them as well. Here's what she writes. After an hours-long witness testimony, a U.S. District Court judge appeared to move closer towards making a final decision on whether or not a group of encampment residents can continue their stay near Steamer Landing Park in Petaluma. Petaluma is a town... let's put it this way. Sausalito is north of San Francisco. Further north is San Rafael. Further north than that is Novato. And further north than that is Santa Rosa. And I think Petaluma is between Santa Rosa and Novato. And on the... weather forecast map that I'm looking at online, it looks like that's exactly where it is on Highway 101, although I'm not sure the mileage. It's about as far away as Vacaville or Fairfield. Well, maybe a little on Fairfield if you were heading northeast. But if you're headed north, slightly northwest on 101, you'd hit Sausalito, and then you'd hit San Rafael, and then Novato, and then Petaluma, and after that, Roner Park and Santa Rosa. And we'll see how many homeless strugglers are going on in those places. If I get the reports, you'll hear about them. Anyway, this is the story that Pereira writes. During the evidentiary hearing Friday, residents described how their stay on the West Side property was greatly due to shelter's failure to meet their needs, while attorney Kevin Gilbert and housing officials pushed off those comments by touting the city's recent expansion of outreach efforts. In the end, Judge Edward Chen set a reconvening date for January 14th and appeared to sway towards lifting a temporary restraining order against the city of Petaluma in the coming weeks. It seems to me, from what I heard, the city is making a very concerted outreach effort, and I will say, more than some other jurisdictions I have seen, Chen said. Of course, I haven't seen the arguments presented by both sides. I know from my experience looking at the claims of attorneys in Santa Cruz and the claims of attorneys in Monterey County and Watsonville, it's frequently the case that the claims made are much broader than the actual resources that are offered. And in fact, it's mostly papering over and giving the judge a sort of an opportunity to ratify police action to destroy encampments. And that's been what I've seen happen in Santa Cruz and happen in Watsonville and happen also in Marina. And you've heard some of that. At least some of the victims' concerns and some activists' discussion of these issues in prior audios. The hearing came, the writer continues, after nearly two dozen encampment residents filed an injunction request October 5th, to keep police from removing people from the site near the smart tracks off of D Street. Judge Chen granted the injunction and has since extended it twice. Chen cited a recently amended complaint by the residents, which was submitted on December 15th. Chen said the amendment could affect the outcome of the injunction because it removes some of the residents from the case who originally submitted the complaint due to, quote, personal resolution, whatever that means. When the suit began, residents cited the lack of proper housing options and argued that the only major option they had was the Mary Isaac Center run by the Committee on the Shelterless, which offered a congregate setting that aggravated many residents' mental health. Matthew Erickson, a two-year encampment resident who took to the virtual stand Friday afternoon, said he suffers from anxiety that is further induced in crowded settings, which is why he'd prefer an option that provides a private room. I lose it, Erickson said, as he described how he feels when put in a congregate situation. I can't stay calm. It's like being in a hypoglycemic shock. Erickson also said he would only agree to move into a shelter if he'd have the option to park his trailer, which he uses every day as an engineering and carpentry workspace. Eugene Riley Drake mentioned his struggle with ADHD and bipolar disorder, and that being in a congregate shelter made him nervous. There's a lot of loud noises there, people always yelling and screaming, Drake said, after describing a past experience at the Hopper Street shelter. He also said that he and his girlfriend, Kamanchamuk Chunwangwagi, would not accept a placement at Mary Isaac's because the facility would not allow them to take in their pet rodents, which they said were caged. It was a topic that took up a good portion of a conversation until Drake ultimately agreed that he could find a trusted person to foster the rodents. The couple would take shelter at an alternate non-congregate option, if he could find a trusted person. A discrepancy caught the attention of the court when Chumwangawagi reneged on where she was staying following Drake's and her stay at the steamer landing property, first stating that she and Drake had provided stay at Drake's mother's house since the end of November. She then said they had gotten access to a room at a Motel 6 for which a friend provided pay. Gilbert questioned her statements and claimed that she and Drake previously told COTS worker Randy Clay in a meeting that they were staying with Drake's mother. Gilbert, who represented the city of Petaluma, later argued that city officials have done all they can to find alternate shelter solutions for the encampment residents but have been met with pushback. We've done a phenomenal outreach effort for far longer than this lawsuit that's been going on over the last year, if not several years. And during that process, every single one of these people has been met with, Gilbert said. And notice the clever wording. It's okay to meet with people all you want, but have you really offered them usable space that has some kind of semi-permanent aspect to it? Or even a so-called pathway to housing? On September 13th, city officials declared a homelessness crisis in Petaluma and have since upped funding efforts and outreach programs to help unhoused residents get shelter and health services. I comment, or so they say. In October, the city applied for up to $24 million in state funding to buy multi-tenant housing through Project Home Key, which has already housed at least 9,000 people statewide. But, of course, getting the funding doesn't mean you use it, you build it, or you spend it in a way that profits those that it's supposed to be spent for. That followed the $338,000 purchase of a People's Village, which will provide 25 interim housing units, mental health services, job aid, and more as an extension of the Mary Isaac Center, the city's largest shelter. Sonoma County supervisors later secured an additional $750,000 for the project in early December, and it's expected to begin the move-in process by the end of January. Housing manager Karen Shimizu, who also testified in the hearing, mentioned how the city has implemented an additional $350,000 this year toward the Downtown Streets Team, a group that assists residents in getting access to case management and employment opportunities. So I wonder if that's the same Downtown Street Team we have here in Santa Cruz, which provides vouchers instead of pay, kind of like company script. Although I have heard it said that that's a way of avoiding losing benefits that you would otherwise lose if you're paid money. But I remain skeptical. Until the People's Village is up and running in the new year, city officials have opened a temporary non-congregate shelter option as an alternative to the Mary Isaac Center. So far, 8 of the 11 rooms have been filled. At Mary Isaac's, there are 20 to 25 available beds, Gilbert said, and while COTS has issued a pair of emergency housing vouchers to residents through the American Rescue Plan Act, those who partner with COTS said that a number of unhoused residents are reluctant to cooperate. One resident was even scheduled to be placed in the Mary Isaac Emergency Shelter on December 15th, but did not show up to the shelter at his scheduled entrance time. We will try our best to try and help them in the process, Gilbert said, but they are not interested. This is the same claim that is being made of Watsonville, the Watsonville refugees who are being who are driven from their homes of some of many years on the Hapaharo River and being offered vouchers for 5 days. I, again, confess to a lot of skepticism, if not downright ridicule for some of these claims. But again, I notice that the media covering this has not really given much time to the attorneys for the plaintiffs, that it is for the homeless. I wonder why that could be. Let's see what we got here. One presented concern involving the Mary Isaac Center was once a resident applies for placement at the shelter, it takes 7 to 14 days for that person to be officially admitted, largely due to COVID-19 protocols. Jules Pelican, homeless services manager with COTS, said the intake process can be lengthy, but can resume quicker if residents come in showing proof that they tested negative for COVID-19 in the past 72 hours. If they haven't had a COVID-19 test that's negative in the past 72 hours, we can help arrange that, Pelican said. We have something that we call a red zone, which is sort of a quarantine area. We can hold up to 8 folks in that area, and we'll set up a COVID test for them, and they can wait there until the results come in. In 2020, nearly 300 Petaluma residents were considered homeless, according to the Sonoma County Homeless Census Comprehensive Report. This seems to me like a report missing any kind of response by the homeless or their attorney. So I think what I'm going to do if I get a hold of Monica Martella again is send her this story and ask her to comment on it. She might have some productive thoughts on it. But let's hear what... let's hear what she has to say about it first. Or let's what she has to say about the situation there. I don't think she necessarily read this story, though. I think it's her local paper, so maybe she did. On the line today, it's almost 10 after 1 on 28th of December, and I'm talking with Monica Martella.
Martella, yes.
Yeah. I have that right, I hope.
Martella with the A at the end, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Okay, cool.
And you're still in the Petaluma scene there? And you're cold, but you're indoors, but you're also maintaining connection with people outdoors.
Correct. Yeah.
So the last time we talked, I guess you were kind of going to make connection with some of the folks who are actually living outside, and I think you may have done so, but I never heard back from you. So I was wondering if you've had any success with that.
Dropped the ball on calling you back.
No problem.
But all we know right now is there was an evidentiary hearing on December 17th, and something must have gone well because the neighbors that are in that particular encampment in Steamer Landing Park have been allowed to stay until another hearing on January 14th. I could be getting that date wrong. The date might actually be January 17th, but in any case, they got a couple more weeks.
And how many folks would you say this impacts, Monica?
I have to guess, so I'm guessing 20 or so.
And how many people in Petaluma should be covered by similar injunctions but aren't?
That there are 300 houseless in Petaluma.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be 275 maybe,
huh.
I'm thinking. And I also noticed that at one of the local businesses, it's got a big parking lot right downtown here. It used to be a little takeout place for fish, and they put a fence around it. And that's what the city does. That's part of their anti-homeless thing.
Uh-huh.
Like, they don't want to leave them any place to go, even during the day. So they're it's a new fence, so I thought I'd mention that.
Hmm. Now, do you have much connection with the folks who are outside the Steamer Lane encampment?
No. You broke off at the end there, but I see them occasionally, but I don't really know any of them. I know some of the people that went from Steamer Landing Park to, there's a shelter with rooms. Let's see, the north end of town. A couple of them went there, so I know them, but mostly just my neighbors in Steamer Landing Park.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still there?
I am still here.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, you're doing good. And I'm doing okay too, I hope. So what exactly is the force of the lawsuit? Have you read about it or heard about it or seen the actual lawsuit itself?
I haven't. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. And do we know what it is? Is there a union of the homeless involved in this, or is it separate attorneys, or is it a good Samaritan in the community, or is it the plaintiffs themselves who are doing it?
There's some local attorneys that are involved, and the neighbors who actually live in Steamer Landing Park. One of them moved on, there were like two or three other people that got together with the attorneys and Sonoma County Legal Aid.
Now, do I understand it right that this is a lawsuit similar to the Sausalito lawsuit, the Novato lawsuit, the Santa Cruz lawsuit, the Pajaro River lawsuit in Watsonville now, that essentially is being done by either homeless folks or advocates for homeless folks who are demanding that people be allowed to shelter in place or that there be adequate shelter elsewhere before they're moved? Or is this a lawsuit that is being done, as it was in San Francisco, to try to demand that the city house homeless people by just to get them off the streets nearby because we don't like all this damn drug dealing, yada, yada, yada?
No, this is a lawsuit protecting their right to be somewhere.
Gotcha.
There's not adequate shelter being offered or actually available to them. And the homeless union, at least an individual who is part of the homeless union is involved. But I don't know personally if he, you know, I think he might be doing that under the umbrella of the California Homeless Union, but he, before he was in the California Homeless Union, he was doing the same type of advocacy, and he does a lot of great work. His name is Robbie Pallison.
Oh, yeah, he's from Sausalito, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And,
yeah, I know he was standing up to police misconduct the other day, getting arrested and so forth.
Yeah, he's been through so much.
And has he been up to Petaluma much?
Yeah, he's pretty much, helped get the folks together and get them organized to do that lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Have you been much in touch with the people doing the lawsuit since you and I spoke?
Yeah, but I can't really get too much in depth, like, because I'm working and stuff. But I just try to keep in touch, and if there's anything I can do to help, I do. There's a few of us.
Well, I appreciate you letting me know about this. You know, you take the initiative, and also it sounds like it's not the easiest thing for you to do, these phone calls. It sounds like you're under some pressure.
I don't know how to word stuff all that great.
doing fine.
So, sorry. And I feel bad because I wish I had more information for you.
No, you're doing good. You know, I mean, it's a kind of a jumping off point. I can, if I want to, I can, you know, start sniffing around. If you can, and again, I guess I have the same suggestion that I did last time. If and when you're able to, or you feel like you know, it's appropriate, if you can get a phone contact with someone who actually is either one of the plaintiffs or closer to them, regularly accessible, then that would be good.
Okay. The last part of that went out, but...
Yeah, in other words, get a phone number of somebody who's in the group or who's close to it if they want to be contacted.
Okay, yeah. The only person who's actually left at Steamer Landing, I could be wrong about this, but it's my understanding, is he doesn't have a phone, so that would be kind of hard.
And I think you may have told me before, but how many people are impacted in the Steamer Landing lawsuit?
In the lawsuit, I believe there's five.
Uh-huh. And is there a larger encampment than five at Steamer Landing?
Yeah.
How many?
Probably about 25 now, because mm-hmm. some of the people did get housed.
And has this lawsuit prompted the authorities in Petaluma to actually find some housing for folks or not?
It's not going to last. It's only for 3 months. But, yeah, there was a couple people that got rooms at a facility that I'm not familiar with at all, but it's not like the congregate shelter. It's separate rooms.
Mm. And what is the... either COVID or general health situation up there among folks outside?
As far as I know, they're all okay. But I just don't really know too much about what's going on in general there, because I just kind of go through there. I have a couple contacts, and they're both okay. I wish I knew more.
Mm-hmm. If folks want to follow more carefully Steamer Landing, do I have that right, Steamer Landing?
Yeah.
Where should they go on the Internet or in other online resources to stay on top of it?
Robbie Pallison's Facebook profile would be good. That last name is Powelson.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I was going to say. Good.
My page, I don't do regular updates, but I do occasionally post about Steamer Landing Park when there's actually something I can, you know, I can follow up on or post about. And then Porchlight Coalition has a Facebook page that also posts about Steamer Landing and the encampment.
Hmm. So it's Monica Martella.
Yeah.
Martella. And also Porchlight
Coalition.
Thank you. Porchlight Coalition. And then finally, Robbie, Robbie Powelson.
Correct.
Then that's on Facebook, you're thinking?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, if there's more you think you want to say, I'm still listening. But, you know, you've given me something. And you've also given folks an avenue to follow if they want to pick up on it more. Is there anything more that you've experienced recently that you think would be helpful for us to know?
No, not really. Sorry about that.
No, you're good. You're good. Well, I'll be putting it out on Thursday night. And if anybody wants to listen to it, you can always go to the Huff website toughsantacruz.org, and then just look under latest and lost shows, and it'll be under that. And after 6 o'clock, it'll be available forever until the website goes down.
So. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, call me anytime, and we'll pick up on it. And don't worry that you don't think you haven't got a great amount to say, or you're not, you know, the professorial type in the classroom, or the smooth, silky-voiced, whatever. That's not the issue.
So. Okay. Yeah, I will call you when or if something changes before, like, January, before the next hearing on the 14th and 17th.
Do you know how many hearings they've had so far?
Two on this. The first one was to get the temporary restraining order.
When was that? More or less.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
I think it was back in September, October, something like that.
I think, yeah. And then the evidentiary hearing happened on December 17th.
Did you attend the hearing, or was it done Zoomed?
I didn't attend either way.
Uh-huh. And so you say the next hearing date is when?
It's either January 14th or January 17th.
And do you know the name of the judge?
I don't. That's a good question.
It might be on Robbie Powelson's Facebook page. It's possible. Or Porchlight Coalition's Facebook page. Or maybe, who knows, even on your Facebook page one of these days.
Yeah, that would be cool.
All right. Well, I'm going to roll on you then, and call me whenever you want.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Hey, me too.
Have a good day.
You too, babe.
All right.
Bye. Bye. So before we check out another musical number by David Rovix, here's a little poem by Joe Schultz, posted on the Facebook page by Grant Wilson. Joe Schultz, as you know, or as you may not know, well, perhaps you know, is the proprietor of a restaurant called India Joe's, as well as a guy who supplies lots of food for folks outside, particularly where there's a large meal required, like and where the city is ducking its responsibilities, or nonprofits are hiding out, or buildings are not available, or where Keith is super strapped and people don't just want to have vegetarian food. And Joe Schultz supplies a little of the meat and potatoes, so to speak. Anyway, he had a poem which I'm going to read called Merry Christmas in Santa Cruz. 'Twas the week before Christmas, and all through the town, all the homeless shivered, those who weren't drowned. Their belongings were ruined, all set for the trash, some hoped for drugs, most lacked the cash. When what to their wondering eyes should appear but Keith McHenry with his Food Not Bombs gear. The tables were set up all neat in the lot, beans and rice were laid out all fresh from the pot. From the top of them all to the back of the lot, at least, 'twas all vegan not. Some cluckers snuck in, and some drinks that went moo. They served it up anyway, 'twas the kind thing to do. So though their RVs were impounded and their sleeping-in cars towed, leaving just streets for their humble abode, they saluted each other with loud laughs and calls, treating each man as brother, people too, who lacked balls. We heard them exclaim as we left them that night, "Merry Christmas to all, please don't be uptight." This next one is called Spies Are Reading My Blog. In August 2013, I was denied entry to New Zealand. I was at the Narita Airport in Japan, aboard a flight for Auckland, when I got a phone call on the cell phone of an airline employee. On the other end was New Zealand Immigration. The immigration agent informed me that she had been reading my blog and that I was not welcome in her country. It was after this that I learned about the Five Eyes Treaty, as it is often known. This was an agreement between the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Australia, and New Zealand, signed in 1948, under which all five companies share all immigration information with each other. So if you're on a watch list in one of these countries, you can be sure you're on exactly the same watch list in all of them.
I should be gigging in New Zealand now, but I'm not. I'm stuck at Narita instead. I should be singing in Dunedin, smoking kiwi pot and chilling with the Kiwi Reds. But when I showed up at the airport to board my flight, I was handed somebody's cell phone. Suddenly the future didn't look so bright and I entered the twilight zone. The woman on the line said, "Hello, I'm from immigration. You may have a ticket, but you can't go to our great island nation." I felt like I'd been hit in the face with a big old Kiwi log. But then I felt the Stasi's cold embrace when she said, "I've been reading your blog. The spies are reading my blog, the introduction and the prologue. And if that's so, it just might be true that they're watching this video too." Well, I normally don't get many views, a few hundred friends and kooks. So it comes as surprising news that some of them are Kiwi spooks. I try to get my missives out and cause some small commotion. Someone's listening now, there's no doubt, across the South Pacific Ocean. The spies are reading my blog, the introduction and the prologue. And if that's so, it just might be true that they're watching this video too. "Were you strip searched in Trondheim?" she asked. "What kinds of things do you smoke? Have you ever been charged with a crime? Are you rich or are you broke? Have you ever been turned away from any borders you tried to cross? What kind of venues did you plan to play? Do you use dental floss?" I said, "It seems a bit unusual for you to do things quite this way." I asked her, "Is this normal?" But she wouldn't say. She'd just repeat her message: "At Narita you shall remain. I've read your blog, each vile passage, and you may not board that plane. The spies are reading my blog, the introduction and the prologue. And if that's so, it just might be true that they're watching this video too. They're watching this video too."
And it's about 10:30 on December 28th. I'm headed into the benchlands from Water Street. I see there's new orange meshing segregating the courthouse grassy area, which is between the jury room. I guess it's the jury room. Used to be a courtroom here, a modular courtroom. And Water Street, which used to be a pathway where you could walk through. On the other side of the bike path, I guess you'd call it, or the pedestrian path that runs along the levee, there are tents that have moved from the benchlands to higher ground, counting about four of them. Still the same three old wash station, double wash stations that are actually, I guess, six wash stations. And it looks like, are they still supplied? We'll see. No problem. Don't hurry. One is occupied. One has toilet paper. And the disabled one is clean, but toilet paper free. And here I'm talking about the three porta-potties, which are right next to the wash stations, the double two-sided wash stations. Well, Whiskers tent. Whiskers? I don't see him. Looks like it may have been abandoned. There are significantly fewer tents here in the benchlands. As I walk toward the pedestrian footbridge, but again, very close still to Water Street. Not many people around. Very muddy. Numerous pools of standing water, but you can negotiate around them. Tents that moved up to the hill, although there is orange meshing off the grass beyond the cement pathway. And I'm talking about people have moved their tents up either toward the courthouse or into San Lorenzo Park proper. Actually, I don't think I saw much in San Lorenzo Park proper. After all, folks are being threatened with tickets, even in the midst of a horrendous rainstorm, according to at least one account. And one guy actually got a ticket, as you may have heard. I think that was Tim. I think that was his name. The foot pathway and the bike pathway. And my first encounter with a couple people said they weathered it, but not too much to say about it, except for the few garbage bags. Hey, want the garbage bag?
Yes, I do, man.
All right. Blood?
Oh, not so much right now.
No hassles? Hmm? No hassles with cops? Or?
No, it's been okay. They pretty much...
Any help?
Yeah, the people, the townspeople keep food, a lot
That's
of
good.
Food, a lot of encouragement, a lot of, you know, necessities otherwise, showing up, buying good food, too.
I see you're still compacted here.
Well, it's not looking good, but it's, oh, well.
I mean, you saved some of your papers.
Look at that, yeah.
It's good, it's good. Are you planning to, what are you planning to do if it?
I'm going to go. Here in a day or two. I'm late, actually. I'm putting it off. Quite a few hundred miles away to sit and edit and edit the Three Princes of Surf documentary.
Oh, really?
Which I own half of with Mike. And we're going to bump that back up and try to get the hype going again. And it is the biggest story in surfing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the day, July 19th, 1885. That three Hawaiian princes sent to a military school here by the father came over, saw the ocean. Of course, they fashioned some surfboards over here and surfed right out here at the river mouth, July 19th, 1885.
Did you create that at the time, or are you doing it historically looking back?
It is exact fact. A friend of ours in our surf club, Big Stick, I believe, he was leafing through the micro thoughts of the old paper Santa Cruz Surf, and he screamed, "They're surfing! They're surfing!" And there was a reporter down there saying they were like walking on water, you know, coming out, coming back. And it took 25 years to find those boards, and we found them.
All right.
Bishop Museum. So it is our, and it will always be our biggest story in surfing, you know, happened right here.
Now you get to surf the mud in the fucking bench lift.
I know. Well, I mean, this has been a personal walkabout that I've hung on to a little bit too long, but I've learned a few things, you know.
You want to say who you are?
They call me Waxfoot in the surf world.
Waxfoot? Robert, that's me.
Oh, that's my middle name.
Huh.
All right, carry on. You're doing a great job, too.
Well, thank you, Wex. I'll give you a card so you can access this if you ever want to hear yourself.
I would. You know.
And that was, I guess, Waxman? Did I have that right? In any case, he told me that...
Waxfoot, please.
Well, he told me what he told me. It looks like the bulletin board and charging station is down... or gone next to the path. And there's all this orange netting that separates all the grass areas on the Ocean Street side of the bike path, I guess.
It might be easier to conceive of it if you look at it as being on the county building side, since the Ocean Street is a little bit further away, but it is on that side in a certain sense. There was a whole charging station that people plugged into and a bulletin board which people put notices on. That is all gone. It was next to a stairway up to the bike path, the concrete bike path.
You could call it. T- intention is to discourage people from setting up their tents there. And now I'm closer to the middle area of the Benchlands encampment. Seems a little drier because it has more open possibility for drying out. Here's one of the pantries that used to be open to everybody. Still, there seems to be some food on the tables. It's called Mama Judy's Honor Pantry, free food. Very few people about.
And this was a series of tables and shelves where people put food, which they exchanged it. They said, just leave it, your food there. Take whatever you want. Leave whatever you can.
Here are a couple. Bring some propane tanks. Here are a couple hugging each other in the distance. A little smoking. Who knows what they're smoking?
Oh, no.
So, you were saying?
You've got to love Santa Cruz.
How's life down here under the somewhat moist benchland?
I'll have to direct you to my friend here.
You're the resident?
I don't really have much to say other than...
Another day in purgatory.
Another day in purgatory.
That's a great one. I agree with him. There you go. Yes.
It's not hell because it's fucking...
You can
still get high and it's pretty cold. But
there you go. Well,
not heaven, you know what I mean? So,
not bad, not good.
It depends on your version of heaven, I suppose, right? Right.
Are you all living down here or just some of you?
I'm dying down here.
Or dying down here,
no,
if you will.
No.
Fuck it. I stayed on here.
Were you here during the storm?
Yes, I was.
And how was that?
It was eventful.
That's
yeah.
Windy?
Not so much wind this time, but
it was wet and slippery. It was how else could you describe it? It was damp. It was moist.
Yep.
Probably could have done a huge non-profit if you would have just had everybody out here ready to mud wrestle and then had all those hotels just, like, ready to go for free, then done, like, a huge kind of
You could be a new
back.
Entrepreneur with a whole new idea.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree. I concur, sir.
Indeed.
Yes.
She's obviously the sage business person here.
Yes.
A lot more tech business savvy than I am.
Very funny. No, nonetheless.
Any community is still happening down here among other people, helping each other or alternately stealing from each other?
There's always going to be the theft,
yeah.
But I would say that it's better. The community is getting better, but still, there's still, you know, a lot of problems.
Right. I think it's consistent on both sides. I think regardless if you're a swindler, a madman, a thief, it doesn't matter. I think it just depends on who you surround yourself with, who your God is, and how you operate in life. That's what I think, anyways.
I think we just need to start picking up our trash more.
Yeah.
Is the city doing regular pickups or not?
I'm not sure. I don't really know.
I wouldn't say regular, but they have a dude.
How about Food Not Bombs?
I haven't seen them down here at all.
I don't think. Not once. They're over there. I've never seen them down here. That'd be awesome if they came down here.
They used to give, I think weekly, they used to bring down a truck with food, I think once or twice a week.
Okay.
Not lately.
Not lately. I will ask them what's going on.
Yeah, get to the bottom of that.
I will get to the bottom of that.
All right, what was your name again?
I'm Robert. I'll give you my card because you can hear yourself on the... On the net, anyway.
Okay.
And we've been talking with, if you want to say.
I'm Tasha Lilly.
And you are?
I'm Jesse.
And who is this questionable individual over here?
Me?
What do you want to call yourself for this interview?
I'm Chris.
Hey, Chris. I'm Robert.
Hey, Robert.
Mucho gusto, senor.
Mucho gusto.
Questionably Chris.
Questionable Chris. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, actually a mailbox on a post, which maybe I missed amidst the jumble of tents before. There's still a occasional power line running across the bench lands.
On the ground, actually.
Power lines, actually. Not as many as in the case before the flooding, or before the two rains, the two heavy rainstorms. County property lawns, as I say, on the non-benchland side of the bike path adjacent to the court and county buildings, is meshed off with orange mesh. The duck pond is not, and the city part of San Lorenzo Park seems not to be. So it's pretty chilly. I'd say it's in the 50s. Can't tell for sure. There's a light wind, and occasionally it's raining. Like Kevin the Goat Guy's tent, or someone else was taking it over, although it now has a small lake as part of its area.
And by Kevin the Goat Guy, I mean an individual. He was right at the bottom of the first set of steps you find as you walk from Water Street along the pedestrian / bike path. And the first set of steps that goes down into the benchlands, at the very bottom of that steps, there was a guy who, Kevin, who had goats and chickens and probably some other creatures as well. And he used to, he would have them kind of, they go up and they'd prune the grass. He would occasionally come to Huff meetings when we were holding them in the benchlands in anticipation of trying to organize some resistance. We anticipated that the city would attempt to move people once the injunction was dissolved. We were wrong. They didn't. At least not yet. And then Kevin is, I haven't seen him, I call him Kevin of the Goats, the Goat Master, though I'm sure that's how he calls himself. Still trying to get in touch with him. Kevin, call home, or call me anyway.
Still at the bottom of this pedestrian stairway, and here's a dead rat on the path. First time I've seen such a thing in Santa Cruz ever. I've seen live rats, but not dead rats. You guys want a garbage bag? Next to a light pole that's close to the Water Street Bridge, just as you come into the benchlands, well, onto the path, there's an enclosure. You can actually hear it if you listen, which is holding a goat. So the goats have been relocated in another area. I'm wondering if that's Kevin's new place. Well, I think I saw him briefly at the homeless memorial a week ago, and he was... He mentioned he'd left the benchlands. Or at least that was the impression I came away with.
And that's all she wrote for this edition of the Bathrobe Spears Broadside Show for the 30th of December. But just to show you that I'm not entirely devoid of festive spirit, here's an old Stan Freberg number called Green Christmas.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Ah, humbug, everybody.
Good morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Well, the meeting will come to order if you please. Are all the advertising people represented here?
Everyone except Amalgamated Cheese.
Well, if they're not here for the Christmas pitch, I can't help them find new ways of tying their product into Christmas. That's why I'm chairman of this board. Let's hear it for me.
Hear, hear, hear!
All right.
right, Abercrombie, what are your people up to?
Oh, same thing as every year. 50,000 billboards showing Santa Claus pausing to refresh himself with our product.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the public has come to expect that.
That's right. It's become tradition.
Fine, fine. You there, Crass. I suppose your company's running the usual magazine ad showing cartons of your cigarettes peeking out of the top of Santa's sack?
Better than that. This year we have him smoking one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It got Santa a little more rugged, too. Both sleeves rolled up and a tattoo on each arm. One of them says, Merry Christmas.
What does the other one say?
Less tars.
Great stuff.
But Mr. Scrooge.
Well, who are you?
Bob Cratchit, sir. I've got a little spice company over in East Orange.